open suddenly, as happens in Martius. But remember, Gordianus, you promised to keep my news a secret. I nodded. Whom would I be tempted to tell? Mito probably knew already. My mind-reading wife and daughter would be harder to keep in the dark, but I would do my best. I stood. Before you go, Gordianus, there's one last thing. Yes? Cinna flashed a crooked smile. It's so trivial I almost forgot. Probably I shouldn't bother to mention it. But as long as you're here... Chapter 11 Cinna dipped a fingertip into his cup of wine, and on the wooden tabletop he traced what looked like a Greek letter. He added letters until a word appeared. Roso K. You know Greek? He said. Enough. I sat down. That's the Greek word for beware. Yes. Someone scratched those letters in the sand in front of my doorstep. When did this happen? A few days ago. Is it still there? Certainly not. I erased it with my foot immediately. I didn't want it to be seen by everyone passing by, and certainly not by any visitor to my house. Which way did the letters face? I mean, was it written so it was right side up as you stepped out of the house, or as you stepped in?
The first.
So it was addressed to someone in the house, not to someone coming to see you.
So it would seem.
Curious that it was written in Greek, not Latin. Curious that it was there at all. Were you alarmed by this message?
Cinna shrugged.
It's not a pleasant word to see as you leave your house.
I should think not.
Do you have any idea who wrote it or why?
Not a clue.
Have you received any other messages of this sort?
Not that I can think of.
A pity you scratched it out. The way any given person makes Greek letters can be quite distinctive.
Cinna shook his head.
I didn't recognize the handwriting, though I admit I didn't scrutinize it very carefully or for very long. My impulse was to erase it at once, before my daughter could see it, though I fear she may have. Sappho is a very sensitive girl.
Sappho?
Though he mentioned her occasionally, this was the very first time I'd heard him call her by name. Is Helvia not pretty enough? That would be the only name assigned her by law. Why shouldn't I bestow on my beloved only child the name of my favourite poet? My favourite in Greek, anyway. Her favourite as well. She knows every line of Sappho by heart. She's even tried to live up to her namesake.
Your daughter writes poetry?
A bit. Nothing special. To be honest, she's not very good. Still, better than Cicero.
For what that's worth, we both laughed.
Do you think this message might have been intended for her?
Cinna furrowed his brow.
That seems doubtful. Sappho's led a very sheltered life. She knows hardly anyone outside the household. I suppose I've been even more protective than most fathers, having lost my wife at a very young age.
He shook his head.
Sappho is such a mild creature, as meek as a sparrow. I can't imagine that anyone would want to harm her.
Then the warning was for you?
Cinna shrugged. Are you worried or not?
Should I be?
Your recent actions as a tribune on behalf of Caesar, contriving a way to expel those two other tribunes who disrespected him, I fear that you deeply offended some of your fellow citizens.
Granted.
And this scheme you're about to launch on Caesar's behalf, this permission to marry and propagate as he wishes, that, too, might cause a few people to get angry at you.
Very angry.
As I've told you, that's a secret.
Nonetheless, someone might have got wind of it.
He shifted a bit in his seat.
Beware. Awfully vague. Beware what or whom?
Could it be that you interrupted the writer before he finished?
I looked up and down the street. I saw no one scurrying off.
He squinted and gazed into the middle distance, picturing the scene.
The way the word was positioned, precisely centered in front of the doorstep, makes me think that single word comprised the entire message.
Puzzling, then, as well as alarming.
Perhaps that was the intention, to cause you distress, a political enemy winding you up. Or could it be a fellow poet? Have you offended some rival versifier, slighted some fledgling author?
They're all jealous of me, of course, just as every senator is jealous of Caesar. Greatness inspires envy, always.
I wouldn't know.
But I'm not actively feuding with anyone at the moment, if that's what you mean. I haven't picked any literary quarrels lately. I've been too busy trying to finish my new poem. That is, when I haven't been listening to complaints and petitions and pleas for my fellow citizens in my role as a tribune.
Your role as a tribune? I think you've put your finger on it. I imagine this word scratched in the sand has something to do with politics. But whether it's a trivial bit of harassment or a serious warning, who can say?
Indeed. Ah, well, I only thought I'd mention it before I forgot about it altogether. I suspect it's of no importance, no importance whatsoever.
Let's hope so.
Well then, off with you. I won't keep you any longer. Fortune be with you until we meet again, Gordianus.
May fortune be with you as well, sinner.
I left the stuffy, warm air of the tavern and stepped into the bracing twilight of an early Martius evening. The few patches of the horizon I could see between the jumble of buildings were a dusky blue. Overhead, the black sky twinkled with stars. I drew a deep breath and tried to blow the fumes of wine from my lungs. I took a few steps and at once regretted having dismissed Caesar's litter. I was a bit drunker than I had thought, and the way home was almost entirely uphill. I took a few more steps, and then froze, for it seemed to me that a figure was approaching from the deep shadows where the narrow, empty street met an intersection. I looked around. There was no one behind me, no one ahead either, except the hulking silhouette. I took a step backward, for the towering figure was most certainly coming closer. Where was my son-in-law when I needed him? At home, with Diana, I thought, where he belonged. If something unpleasant was about to occur, I couldn't blame Davis, only myself. Any other man of my wealth, no matter how newly acquired, would have hired a professional bodyguard or two to shadow his every step. I had preferred to spend the money on household slaves for Bethesda and a tutor for my grandchildren. The figure moved closer. I took another step back and stumbled. I righted myself and suddenly felt quite sober. The figure made a sniggering noise, as if amused by my awkwardness. In the eerie silence that followed, I heard the booming sound of my own heartbeat. Why had I so casually dismissed Caesar's litter-bearers? Because I'd had my fill of people demanding my attention, and I wanted to be left alone. I wanted to step into the salacious tavern with no one waiting for me outside, a free man, unfettered by worries and cares. I was worried now. The shadowy figure spoke in a deep, steady voice.
I haven't frightened you, have I? I recognized the voice of Hipparchus, the leader of Caesar's litter-bearers. He moved closer. His face was lit by dim starlight. I pressed my hand to my chest, trying to muffle the booming of my heartbeat. "What were you thinking, sneaking up on me like that? And what are you still doing here? I sent you back to Caesar."
"Apologies, citizen."
He lowered his head. Being so tall, he still looked down on me. "I sent back the litter and the other bearers, but I couldn't leave you here alone. Caesar would never forgive me if something untoward befell a guest on his way home. I decided to wait here, outside the tavern, out of sight, so as to attract no attention."
"You were certainly out of sight until you came lumbering toward me. You might have spoken sooner."
"Apologies, citizen. I've been taught not to speak until spoken to, unless it's absolutely necessary. I kept my mouth shut until I saw the look on your face."
"Yes, I understand.
What a frightened old man I must have looked for such a well-mannered slave to snigger at my misstep. I thought of the doddering, panic-stricken old fools who were stock characters in Roman comedies. Is that what I had come to resemble? After so many years of rectitude and striving, I stood stiffly upright and drew the folds of my toga more securely around me. That, too, was a stock character, the put-upon man of affairs in a toga trying not to look a fool. I stared at Hipparchus. At least he wasn't laughing at me. I suppose you'll want to accompany me all the way home."
"If you'll allow me, citizen," Hipparchus said, sounding quite respectful. I took a deep breath. I collected my wits until I felt myself again. I was Gordianus the Finder, citizen of Rome, world traveller, friend of famous poets and dictators alike, soon to be a senator. No man's fool, surely.
Chapter 12.
To say that I hoped to skulk unobserved into my own home would do me a disservice. That would cast me as yet another laughable character from Plautus. Nonetheless, when I arrived at my front door, with a watchful Hipparchus striding dutifully beside me, I lifted a finger to my lips to demand his silence, and made a very gentle knock. What were the chances I could shush the slave who opened the door before he could say a word, slip quietly inside, and find some hiding place where no one would bother me until I was entirely sober? My hope was thwarted. Whichever slave was supposed to be minding the front door at that hour, I left it to Bethesda to assign such duties, was either absent or asleep. I knocked a bit louder, then, with a sigh of exasperation, louder still. At last, the peephole opened, and I saw the eyes of my daughter staring back at me.
"Papa, what took you so long? Mother's getting worried."
The peephole was shut, the lock gave a rattle, and the door swung open. Diana stepped to the threshold. Her dark hair was done up in some fashion I'd never seen before, with combs and pins and a slender silver chain holding it all together. There was a new slave in the household, a very expensive eunuch from Egypt, who had been purchased because he was expert at creating such hairstyles. I turned and gestured to Hipparchus. "As you can see, daughter, and attest to your mother if necessary, I was never alone or in any danger, thanks to the diligence of this fine servant of the dictator."
"I see,"
said Diana, appraising Hipparchus a bit more closely than was necessary. "You may leave me now," I said to Hipparchus.
"No, wait."
I stepped inside the door and reached for a small bowl in a niche, in which were stored small coins suitable for gratuities to delivery men and messengers. I pressed a few pieces of copper into Hipparchus's hand. Your master needn't know that I gave you this.
Thank you, citizen, he said, but with his eyes on Diana, not me. The two of them seemed to have arrived at some tacit agreement allowing the mutual gratification of their ocular senses, at the risk of playing yet another stock character, the disapproving father. I felt obliged to step between them. The interruption seemed to break some invisible thread of tension, for they simultaneously released very faint noises of regret, one coming in my right ear and the other in my left.
But, Hipparchus continued, I could never accept any gratuity, no matter the size, without informing my master.
Tell Caesar, then, if you wish, I said, thinking that such a small transaction could hardly merit the attention, even for the blink of an eye, of a man with Caesar's responsibilities. But from single stones are built the longest roads, as my father used to say. No detail was too small to escape Caesar's attention. The loyalty of every man, from slave to senator, mattered to him. With a last stolen glance at my daughter, the slave took his leave. I turned toward Diana, thinking to rebuke her with a raised eyebrow, but found myself face to face with my wife. Her hair was combed and piled up in an even bolder fashion than that of my daughter. She couldn't have been that worried about me if she had spent the afternoon with Diana, doing up their hair. At least they were putting the new slave to good use.
"Husband, you smell of—"
she began, but I pressed a finger to her lips. "Say nothing, wife, until you've heard my news. Diana, gather everyone in the household, including the slaves. I might as well tell all of you at once and be done with it. Come, we'll do it in the garden. Light lamps and braziers. I want to see everyone's face when I deliver the news." Diana rounded them up. There were the two slaves who cooked and ran the kitchen, and the three who cleaned the house and kept the garden, and were supposed to take turns minding the front door. There was another who sewed and did shopping, and her small son, who ran errands and took messages, and, of course, the new one, who applied cosmetics to my wife and daughter and dressed their hair, and yet another couple of slaves who surely did something all day. Bethesda must have known their duties, though I did not. There was no point in trying to keep the news from any of them, because household slaves inevitably discover everything of importance that takes place in the house. They might, if they feared or loved or respected me enough, be trusted to keep the knowledge to themselves and not spread it outside the house. I made sure that was the first thing I said. "Say nothing of this to anybody until after the Ides," looking not only at the slaves but also at Diana and Davis and Bethesda, as well as little Aulus and tiny Beth, for even my grandchildren would know the word senator, and might repeat it in public unless admonished not to.
"Well, husband, what is it? What have you to tell us?"
Bethesda looked at once dubious and quietly excited. A part of her, suspicious as a cat, thought I must be up to no good. Another part thought I must have a good reason to gather them all in one place to make my announcement. "As you know, Mito dropped in on us earlier today and swept me off to visit the dictator at Caesar's request." "Are you in trouble?" said Davis. A furrow of concern creased his broad forehead. "You might say that. You might say that I've been made an offer of the sort no man can refuse."
"An offer?" said Bethesda. "Holy Isis, husband, what are you talking about? Has Caesar offered you work?"
"You might say that as well."
"What can the man possibly want from you at your age?
You're a respectable member of the Equestrian Order now. I won't have you digging through people's rubbish and getting yourself into trouble, not even for Caesar. Why was I hesitating? I had heard the words spoken by Caesar, by Mito, and by Cinna, but I myself had not yet said them. Words once spoken can never be called back. It was as if the words themselves contained a sort of magic, like a spell, irrevocable once uttered.
Yes, Papa?
Said Diana. I'm going to be, that is, Caesar has appointed me, or will appoint me, on the Ides,
husband.
Bethesda almost shouted. Her lips trembled. There was a look on her face I'd never seen before. She had guessed what I was about to say and could hardly contain herself. Diana looked from one of us to the other, not quite understanding, but sensing the enormity of the thing yet to be spoken. Like her mother, she trembled. Davos put his arm around her. The excitement was contagious. Aulus clutched his father, little Beth her mother, and both let out a scream.
"I'm going to be a senator," I said, in a low, hoarse voice, so unfamiliar in my ear that I felt compelled to say it again.
I'm going to be a senator. Bethesda rushed into my arms. Diana followed, as did the children. Davos blinked and staggered a bit, as if I had smacked his forehead. The slaves burst into applause. I felt somewhat unsteady, but was in no danger of falling, encircled by so much adoration. Was this what real politicians felt when crowds of cheering well-wishers lifted them on their shoulders? Was this what Caesar felt when senators sprang to their feet and shouted his name as if he were a god?
"We must send word to Eco and Menenia at once," cried Bethesda, between planting kisses all over my face. She was ecstatic, and why not? She had come the farthest of anyone in that house. She had been born a slave in Egypt, but would end her days as the wife of a Roman senator. "Oh, what will Fulvia say?"
No, wife. Did you not hear me? No one must be told until it actually happens, on the Ides.
Don't be ridiculous. You can't keep such a thing secret. For one thing, you'll need to go shopping for a new toga, a senator's toga.
She's right, Papa, said Diana. There can't be more than a handful of tailors who specialize in such an item, and even the most reputable tailors are notorious for spreading gossip. They see everyone stripped naked, so to speak.
Why would you want to keep it a secret anyway? Said Davos.
I blinked. Fear of the evil eye? Even Roman generals feared the misfortune that might arise from envy. That was why chariots in triumphal processions were fitted with an ancient phallic talisman underneath, to ward off the black magic that might emanate from so many jealous onlookers. That was why mothers put such talismans in the cribs of their newborns, to ward off the malevolent envy of women who were barren or whose babies had died.
Never fear. Mother and I will do all that can be done to propitiate the gods and ward off ill fortune, said Diana. Mother knows Egyptian spells she's never even shared with me, and we can ask Fulvia. She knows a lot about such things.
That Fulvia is a sorceress, I don't doubt, I laughed, but not the most successful, to judge by her string of dead spouses.
Husband, that is just the sort of quip that might attract the evil eye, not to mention the ire of Antony, a man you can hardly afford to offend, since Caesar will be leaving him in charge after he goes, and you're to be
a senator.
Bethesda, too, felt the strange, giddy power of speaking the word aloud. She clapped her hand over her mouth.
Dinner that night was a celebration. Bethesda called for the best wine in the house. While not in a class with the Falernian I had been drinking with Cinna, it was quite pleasant to the taste, especially accompanying a hearty lamb stew. The cooks outdid themselves. Every word Bethesda said, every movement she made, seemed slightly more calculated than usual, more elegant, more refined. It was as if she were trying on the guise of a Roman senator's wife, which fit a bit snugly, but flattered her nonetheless. To see her thus stimulated and gratified was the most compelling reason to accept Caesar's appointment. For Bethesda to be a senator's wife, I had to be a senator. So be it. Diana, too, seemed quietly content. She wore a heavy-lidded expression like that of a purring cat. Davis, always affable, seemed happy for the rest of us, but surely he, too, felt a sudden welling of pride. Having attained freedman status by impregnating secretly, and then marrying, with my blessing, my daughter, he would now be a senator's son-in-law, and his children would also rise in status. Later, after all the food and drink had been cleared away, and everyone else had gone off to bed, everyone except Bast the cat, whose silhouette prowled the rooftop, I sat alone in the garden, under the starlight, huddled close to the last flickering brazier. "I'm a new man," I whispered to myself, for thus were called those who were the first of their family to rise to the Senate. But was I truly made anew just because Caesar said so? Surely I was the same now as I had been yesterday, and would be so on the Ides of Martius as well, and the day after. New obligations I would have, new expenses, new demands from my wife and daughter, new pressures to take sides in one dispute after another. I looked up at the stars and sighed.
"Your father would be very proud of you," said a hushed voice.
For an uncanny moment I imagined it was my long-dead mother speaking. I hadn't thought about her voice in a long time. I had forgotten how she sounded, but now suddenly remembered. So similar in that moment was the voice of my daughter, who stepped from the shadows into the glow from the brazier. "You never knew my father," I said.
"No, but you're thinking about him right now."
"Mind reader." Diana shrugged.
"It was in your sigh."
I nodded. It was the very first thought that occurred to me when Caesar told me, once my mind settled down enough to have a rational thought. What would my father think?
I often think those words myself. What would father think? Meaning you. Quite often it's the thing that matters to me most of all.
Only quite often? Not all the time? A Roman father's will should transcend all other concerns, even to matters of life and death.
I do have a husband to think of, you know, and an Egyptian mother. Diana laughed. But you always come first, Papa. I am a good Roman daughter.
And soon the daughter of a Roman senator. She gazed at the crackling flames in the brazier.
Papa, it's incredible.
She spoke quietly, but her eyes were very wide. I know. And you're right. My father would be very proud of me. I felt a tear slip down my cheek. It must have glittered in the light, for Diana reached out and touched it with a fingertip. We sat for a long time in silence.
"What a day you've had," she finally said. "Cicero and Caesar in a single day. I know why Caesar wanted to see you, but what did Cicero want?"
He was eager to hear my thoughts on his new dissertation. On Divination is the title.
She raised a sceptical eyebrow. "You'll have to come up with something better than that."
"Very well, the truth. Cicero thinks there might be a plot afoot to harm Caesar. He wanted me to look into the matter."
"If there were such a plot, I think Cicero would be at the heart of it."
"A plot to depose Caesar, perhaps, but not to murder him. That would not be Cicero's way. But he thinks there may be those who feel otherwise, who wouldn't stop at violence. For all I know, he may be right."
"And if you uncovered such a plot, what would Cicero do about it?"
"Lecture the plotters, I imagine. He feels neglected, left behind, irrelevant.
But at this point, who would want Caesar dead? The civil war is over at last, and from what I understand, Caesar has been far more merciful than those who fought the last civil war, men like Marius and Sulla."
"But none of those men made himself dictator for life. It's hard for many Romans to stomach. I find it rather distasteful myself."
"Even though the dictators now made you a senator?"
"And what does that mean? In a senate that serves to ratify one man's will." The brazier crackled and hissed.
"What if Caesar were to die suddenly, Papa? It needn't be murder. He could die from natural causes. What would happen then? What if Caesar died in his sleep this very night?"
"Then there would be no Parthian campaign, no string of conquests from here to India, no fresh sources of plunder to pour riches into Rome."
"That would be bad for Mito."
"Or good, if he means he won't die on some battlefield 1,000 miles from home."
"And here, in Rome?"
"A mad scramble for power, chaos, revenge, recriminations, another civil war, almost certainly. Unthinkable."
"And even more unthinkable, in all the confusion and without Caesar as your champion, you might not become a senator after all."
"That would be a disaster for your mother."
"Yes, it would." "Have you ever seen her so thrilled?"
I shook my head. "What a thought. The death of the world's most powerful man, probably the most powerful man in history, a veritable god, a death that would alter the destiny of the world, might also frustrate the social aspirations of a certain Roman housewife." I laughed. "We must keep things in perspective."
"But isn't the perspective of every mortal the same, Papa? With the universe circling around and oneself at the centre?"
I stood and yawned, finally weary enough to sleep. "But what are we worrying about? Cicero's fears are exaggerated, I'm sure. I am to be a senator. Mito will go off to Parthia and come back a hero covered in glory. Caesar will rule the whole world from Spain to India and outlive me. You and your children will grow up in the richest, most peaceful, most wisely ruled empire the world has ever known." Diana smiled.
"Of course, Papa. It shall be just as you say."
She kissed my cheek, and the two of us went to join our slumbering spouses. Day 2, March 11th. Chapter 13. My sleep was surprisingly sound, considering the excitement of the day. I was awakened early the next morning, well before dawn, by the amorous advances of my wife. It had been a while since we made love. Pent-up desire might partly explain the enthusiasm she showed, but I suspect that waking up next to a soon-to-be senator was the thing that most excited her. We hadn't coupled with such passion in months, perhaps even years. As our bodies touched and moved against one another, I returned in memory to
to the young man I once had been, when I was living in Alexandria and I first laid eyes on Bethesda. The pleasure I experienced transcended time. I was at once in the moment, and also in all the moments of the many, many occasions we had made love over the years. I felt enfolded by the passage of time, not my enemy, but my friend, for had it not delivered me to this present moment of consummate bliss? Afterward, wide awake and whistling the tune of an old love song from my Alexandra days, I made my way to the garden. I wrapped my cloak around me as I sought the warmth of the brazier that had been glowing all night, and now was being stirred into open flames by one of the slaves. I had in my hand the brief list of names Caesar had given me the previous day. I remembered his words. "Drop in on certain men, find some pretense for your visit, and while you're there, keep your eyes and ears open for any bit of useful information. Use that power of yours to draw the truth out of men." Ironically, the first name on the list was Cicero, the one man I was certain posed no threat to Caesar. The frustration he had expressed at being left out of any plots had been too genuine even for Cicero to fake. How flattered he would have been to know that his name headed Caesar's list. As I perused the other names, it occurred to me that Caesar himself had provided a suitable pretext for these visits. I was to become a senator. If the fact couldn't be kept secret, then I might as well use it to my advantage. As the men on the list were all senators themselves, I could say I was seeking advice as a new man soon to join their ranks. Indeed, it might be revealing to see how each man reacted to the news that Caesar was to make Gordianus the Finder a senator. I decided to start with the man about whom I knew the least, and about whom I was most curious. Spurinna, the Etruscan Haruspex, who had been made a senator by Caesar. It was in his role as a diviner that Spurinna had delivered the warning to Caesar that he would be in danger until the middle of Martius. Mito had told me where Spurinna lived. Dawn was too early to call on a man of such importance, so I bided my time for an hour or so before I set out, wearing my toga and taking Davis for protection. As I was stepping out the front door, Bethesda appeared, still in dishabille, and looking more desirable than any other women in Rome half her age. She asked where we were off to. "Tending to some senatorial business," I told her, not entirely a lie, at which she seized my shoulders and gave me a long kiss that took my breath away. As we set off down the street, Davis looked at me sidelong and made a low whistle that broke into a knowing grin. "Diana was the same last night," he confided. "You should become a senator every day." Spurinna lived in a rather grand house on the Aventine Hill. An obsequious slave admitted us to an exquisitely furnished reception room, then scurried off to inform his master. The floor was paved with geometric mosaics, and the wall panels were alternately red and orange. For decoration, there were some very fine pieces of terracotta sculpture, executed in the old Etruscan style that collectors find so desirable. A smiling man and woman, almost life-size, reclining together on a couch as if to dine. A smaller piece that depicted two dancers with open arms looking skyward. And, at the centre of the room, set atop a black marble pedestal, a small but exquisite statue of a mounted warrior wearing a three-horned helmet. "Haruspicy must be a profitable business," said Davis, following my gaze. "Perhaps. But according to Cicero, Spurinna comes from a very old and distinguished Etruscan family. New man he may be, but there's likely to be an ancestral fortune. These terracotta pieces may be family heirlooms.
So they are,
said a reedy voice, from the lilting accent common to those who come from the more northerly Etruscan cities, farthest from Rome.
Welcome to my home, Gordianus.
Spirinna was dressed neither in a senatorial toga nor in the costume of a haruspex, but in an elegantly tailored tunic of pale linen, cinched at his narrow waist with a thin leather belt. He was completely bald, but had a long, very thick beard mingling silver and black. There was something disconcerting about his face. I realized that his dark eyes and eyebrows weren't symmetrical, with one side higher than the other, a peculiarity that created odd expressions. "Thank you," I said. "This is my son-in-law, Davis. I don't think we've met before.
But I know who you are, just as you must know who I am."
I nodded. "We have that in common, that each has knowledge of the other, but we have something else in common,
do we?
Caesar made you a senator, did he not?"
"Yes, to the dismay of some, but to the delight of my family."
"I can say the same, or rather, I'll be able to say so a few days from now." Spirinna gave me a keen look.
"Are you saying that Caesar is making you a senator?"
Spoken without emotion, the question gave no clue as to what he might feel about the matter. "Yes, on the Ides." Spirinna raised an eyebrow, which, on his face, had an effect opposite that of most people, for it brought his features into alignment and erased any hint of irony. He was a hard man to read.
"How interesting! So much is likely to happen on the Ides."
"What do you mean?"
"Come, Gordianus, you will have heard about my warnings to Caesar, perhaps from that son of yours, who happened to be present when I conveyed the omen divine from the sacrifice."
"You warned Caesar of a threat hanging over him. You told him to be careful for the next 30 days.
"Exactly. The period of greatest danger will expire just after the Ides."
"What if you're wrong?" Spirinna looked down a hallway toward a portico, where a patch of morning sunlight had appeared.
"Come, let's talk in the garden. I think today will be warmer than yesterday."
There were more terracotta statues in the garden. We followed him to a pair of benches close to an image of the goddess Turan, said by some to be the same as a Roman Venus, despite the wings that sprouted from her back. Spirinna and I sat, while Davis leaned against a pillar.
"If the eyes should come and go and nothing untoward befall Caesar," said Spirinna, "I should be delighted, of course. Haruspicy isn't an exact science. Interpreting the divine signs is a tricky business, even for the most experienced practitioner like myself. Or it might be that Caesar will escape the threat precisely because of my warning. No matter that he scoffs at it. Who knows what choices Caesar will have made in light of my divination, knowingly or not? Choices that will have steered him away from danger."
"I see your point. If the warning successfully protects Caesar, then the threat will remain unseen, and there'll be no proof of the divination's accuracy. Perhaps you might explain that conundrum to Cicero. He's writing a treatise on divination." Spirinna snorted.
"And how could he possibly be qualified to do that? Is that why you're here? Did he send you to feel me out about contributing to his impious efforts?"
"No, I wasn't sent by Cicero. I mentioned him and his work only because I happened to see him yesterday."
And what does that old crow make of your elevation to the Senate?
Actually, he doesn't yet know. Or at least, he didn't know when I saw him, and neither did I.
So, this had only just happened?
I was told by Caesar yesterday.
Ah, that explains why I'm only now learning about it. I'm usually abreast of all developments surrounding the dictator, even those of little consequence.
That certainly puts me in my place, I thought. Are you so knowledgeable because of your connection with the dictator's wife? Again, I was frustrated when I tried to read his expression, but his voice sounded vaguely amused.
Calpurnia has come to rely on me, yes, and I see her often. In matters of divination, she's more devout than her husband. Such is frequently the case. Women are more sensitive, more receptive than our men to divine manifestations.
Yet only men practice haruspicy.
Women have their own ways of divining, largely outside the control or the knowledge of the state, or of men in general. Conversely, the divination of men is regulated with ranks and rules, priesthoods and colleges. There are exceptions. The women who become vestals are very much part of the state religion, and undoubtedly there are men who, in secret, practice sorcery, just as many, perhaps most, perhaps all, women do. But you must know all about such things, eh, Finder? Your career must have brought you into contact with many a seer and diviner.
True. I happen to have met the Haruspex who preceded you as Calpurnia's confidant, that fellow Porsena, not long before he met his untimely end. Did I see a frown on his lopsided face? I should think the Haruspex who dies of violence is probably not the best practitioner of his craft, I added, unlike yourself, I'm sure.
Indeed. My personal divinations indicated that I would have unexpected visitors today. That certainly describes you and your son-in-law, Finder. And though you are most certainly welcome, I'm still unaware of the purpose of your visit.
I wanted to see with my own eyes the man who publicly warned Caesar of a threat hanging over him, I thought. I wanted to hear you speak, watch you move, observe your dress and the place where you live. But what I said was, the reason is quite simple. I need to acquire a new toga to suit my new rank, and I have no idea where to make such a purchase, especially on such short notice. I mentioned this in passing to my son, Mito, and he said, "Why don't you ask Spurinna?" He acquired his senatorial toga not that long ago, and everyone knows he's a man of impeccable taste. I seldom resorted to outright lying, but this untruth seemed harmless enough, and Spurinna would never doubt it. Men who dressed as elegantly as he did, and furnished their homes with such fine works of art, never question a compliment.
You must go to Mamercus, of course. His shop is on the so-called Street of the Ironmongers. His family has been in the business for generations. Mention my name, and I'm sure he'll treat you very well.
Excellent. Davis, you'll remember that, won't you?
Mamercus the Tailor, Street of the Ironmongers, said Davis slowly, as if learning a foreign phrase.
Having been complimented and beseeched for a favour that cost him nothing, Spurinna finally let down his guard. I detected a slight relaxation around his mouth and a more friendly glimmer in his eyes. I lowered my voice.
But what can you tell me about this threat to Caesar, the one you've foreseen? I can't help but be curious. You are, after all, the foremost Haruspex in Rome. Additional flattery relaxed him even more.
Did your divination shed light on the nature of the threat? Did it point to any particular individuals, or even the sort of men who might be involved?
I see that you're genuinely worried about our mutual benefactor, said Spirinna. So I'll tell you what I can.
He raised a finger to his bearded chin and furrowed his brow. One side of his face looked more thoughtful than the other.
You presume the threat to Caesar is from other mortals. In fact, it could be from some natural danger. It might even emanate from some divine agency.
But if that's the case, of what use is a warning? How is Caesar to avert such a nebulous threat?
Prudence. The dictator must avoid every kind of accident that might naturally occur in the course of a day. A fall downstairs, a slip at the baths, a burn from a flaming brazier. He must do nothing to incite the wrath of any deity. He must make every proper sacrifice and observe all rituals necessary to placate the gods. He must ward off witchcraft. Calpurnia can help him with that. For if the threat is indeed human, it might arise not from his rivals or enemies, but from their wives or widows.
And there are so many widows in Rome, I sighed. Such a wide array of threats.
Mortal dangers beset every man every day, but for Caesar the peril is acute, and will remain so until the 30 days have passed.
Then may the Ides come and go swiftly.
Indeed, said Spirinna.
Indeed,
echoed Davis with surprising vehemence. When I gave him a curious look, he added, For after the Ides, you'll really be a senator, and think how pleased our wives will be. Spirinna gave Davis a wry glance. Half of his face looked incredulous, and the other half amused. He laughed.
Ah, wise you are, big fella. In the end, it all comes back to pleasing our wives and mothers, doesn't it? That's so even with Caesar.
It seemed to me unlikely that Caesar's career owed much to pleasing Calpurnia, or Cleopatra, or any other female. Spirinna saw the doubt on my face.
It's true, Finder. You must know the story of Caesar's dream the night before he forded the Rubicon. To cross that boundary with his army meant that civil war would inevitably commence. And what did he dream the night before? That he slept with his mother.
I nodded. Mito had told me the story. How had Spirinna heard it? From Calpurnia? Did everyone in Rome know?
And far from putting him off, said Spirinna, the dream spurred him on to cross the Rubicon and fulfil his destiny, to please his mother, don't you see?
I blinked. Is that your interpretation?
What other is there?
I should have thought, I hesitated, I should have thought that the maker of our dreams was warning Caesar that by marching on Rome he was about to commit an unnatural act.
Nonsense, says Spirinna. That's why I'm a haruspex and you are not.
True, the work of reading omens would never suit me.
The role of a senator will suit you much better, I think.
I have my doubts about that, but it's kind of you to say so. I decided I rather liked the man, despite our different ways of looking at the world. It also seemed to me that Spirinna posed no threat to Caesar, nor did he have anything useful to say, if such a threat existed. Chapter 14 Shall we go to that tailor the Haruspex recommended? Asked Davis, as we made our way down the street in front of Spirinna's house. I remember the name and the location.
So do I, Davis.
But on a matter as weighty as having a toga fitted, surely I should get a second opinion. I think we have time for another visit before midday. If I remember correctly, down that street there is the house where Marcus Junius Brutus lives. I wonder if he might receive an unexpected visitor. The house of Brutus was far less ostentatious than that of Spurinna. There was often such a distinction between the old and the new in Rome. Ancient, as Spurinna's Etruscan bloodline might be, in Rome he was very much a newcomer, and always would be, whereas no one in Rome could claim a pedigree as old and distinguished as that of Brutus, who descended from the Brutus who drove out the last king and founded the Republic more than 400 years ago. Such a man has no need of decorations and ornaments to proclaim his arrival. He had arrived even before he was born. So I wasn't surprised to see that his residence looked, more than anything else, old. Among all the surrounding houses, it looked by far the oldest. The architecture was plain and simple. The clay tiles along the roofline were chipped and weathered. The stone steps leading up to the door had been worn in the middle from countless footsteps. To those footsteps I added my own, and those of Davis. Even the door was old and chipped, especially around the much-used peephole, where an eye perused us for a long moment before the door swung open on creaking hinges. We were led down a long gallery. From niches on both sides the death mask of scores of ancestors gazed sternly. Among them, set in a niche of honour, slightly larger than the rest, I recognised the bearded, austere countenance of Lucius Junius Brutus, founder of the Republic. Once past this intimidating display of ancestry, I found the interior of the house to be no less simple than the exterior. There wasn't much furniture in the room where we were invited to wait, and the pieces looked exceedingly uncomfortable. It was as if cushions and chairs with backs hadn't yet been invented. One wall had been painted with some sort of scene, perhaps, of a hunt, but the image was so faded I could hardly make it out. The most striking feature of the room was its terracotta statuary. Unlike the splendidly preserved pieces in Spurinna's house, these specimens, displayed on simple pedestals, appeared to be mere fragments, bits of geometric and vegetal decoration. A gigantic horse's head, and remnants of a masculine figure, including a large hand clutching a rein. Like those of Spurinna, these pieces were almost certainly of Etruscan manufacture. Etruscan artisans introduced terracotta statuary to Rome, including the giant statue of Jupiter with his chariot and horses atop the original temple of the god on the Capitoline Hill, a structure long ago lost to fire and demolished and rebuilt. I peered at one of the fragments, a leaf-like architectural device the size of my head with chipped edges and much faded colour, and suddenly realised what I was seeing. These pieces called to mind the fabled quadriga of Jupiter atop the temple, because they were that statue, or what remained of it. The disembodied hand holding a rein wasn't just any hand, but was a hand of Jupiter himself, and not just any Jupiter, but one of the oldest images of the god ever created for the city of Rome. I let out a small gasp, just in time for my host to hear. Had I contrived it intentionally, I could have devised no better way to ingratiate myself, for he knew at once the reason for my surprise. "These aren't actually," I said. "They most certainly are," said Brutus. He was a handsome man with a long face and keen eyes. He wore a simple white tunic embroidered with a Greek key pattern in blue. But that would mean these pieces are even